Yeah, we're happy to have Jeff Pennington here. Going well, who's, as you have heard, in a superposition of IES and Berkeley, and he's going to tell us about corrections to the leading order QS prescription. So take it away.
Okay. Awesome. Okay, so thank you very much for inviting me to give a talk. Indeed, I'm talking about leading order corrections QS prescription, which is a paper that came out back in August with Chris Akers. Obviously, you know, very boring slide, as everyone knows. We have this duality between gravity and ADS and a conformal field theory. And one of the big aims in theoretical physics for the last 15, 20 years has been to understand the dictionary between the two sides of this duality. And in particular, there's this thing called the Ryotaki-Inagi formula that says that if you look at the reduced density matrix of some boundary region in the conformal field theory, then the entropy of that density matrix is dual to the area of the minimal bulk surface anchored on the boundary region. So this formula is very powerful, but it really needs to be generalized when you include quantum effects. And basically the way it gets generalized is that the area gets replaced by what's called the generalized entropy, which has an additional contribution from bulk entanglement between quantum fields on either side of the surface. So for example, if you have two blue fish are entangled with each other, then the entanglement between them contributes to the generalized entropy of this red surface. Okay, so the QES prescription can be derived just using a gravitational path integral and certain assumptions that will play an important role in this talk. And it's seen a large number of successes. In particular, it leads to a correct derivation of the page curve, a unitary page curve for an evaporating black hole. Okay, so that's just background to the background before I even sort of summarize what I'm going to talk about in this talk. Because basically, what I have to say is that if you just take this rule, this QES prescription, and you just naively apply it to states with arbitrary bulk quantum states, then you get paradoxical results. And in fact, these paradoxes already exist even if you only trust the prescription at leading order in Newton's constant, G Newton. So we can't say that sort of, oh, the QES prescription is basically right, but you need to have some little corrections to fix some small errors. It really is just as wrong as can be. The leading order contribution is wrong. So these paradoxes can be seen if you look at evaporating black holes for particular calculations. But they can also be seen in states that don't involve any black holes at all. All they really need is some source of like a pretty large leading order amount of bulk entropy, of bulk degrees of freedom. So the good news is that even though the QES prescription is paradoxical, might be a bit worrying given how much we've relied on it in recent years to have these successes, if you do more careful entropy calculations using what's called the replica trick, then you actually do get consistent results. You don't find any paradoxes, everything makes sense. And instead, what you see is that the assumptions that were needed to derive the QES prescription actually fail even when you just look at the leading order answer. So certain approximations just cause big errors. So instead, what we need to do is we need to replace the sort of naive quantum extremal surface prescription that people have been using until now by a more refined version. And that refined version is going to involve what's called smooth min-max entropies, which are concepts from quantum information theory, in particular from what's called one-shot quantum Shannon theory. So one-shot quantum Shannon's theory studies like information theory when you only have a single copy of a quantum state. In holography, we only have a single copy of a quantum state. So at some level, this isn't surprising, but it's very different than the quantities like the von Neumann entropy that have been showing up until now. In some sense, we're moving the QES prescription beyond just the thermodynamic limit. All the results that I'm going to be talking about, and in particular, the sort of consequences of those results for entanglement wedge reconstruction end up being very closely related to sort of a subfield of one-shot quantum Shannon theory, particular quantum information theoretic task, which is called one-shot quantum state merging. And in fact, you can think of gravity as being as implementing one-shot quantum state merging, and in fact, it does so in a maximally efficient manner. It saturates the capacity of a certain channel for doing one-shot quantum state merging. Okay, so that's sort of a big picture preview of the stuff I'm going to cover. There's quite a lot of stuff in this paper. It ended up being like 90 pages long or something. So my talk's going to be kind of high-level, broad overview for certain parts without having time to really go through all the details. But the first thing I want to get across is just why we have a problem with the naive quantum extremal subscription. Why just applying it blindly leads to paradoxical results. Okay, and the first example I'm going to show where this happens is what's called a dust ball in ADS3. So this example goes back to a paper by Akers, Leichenau, and Levine from last summer. And the setup is the following. We consider ADS3 CFT2, and we consider a boundary region consisting of two intervals. Okay, so this boundary region I'm calling big B, and it consists of a region at the top and a region at the bottom. This boundary region has two extremal surfaces, two candidates for the minimal surface in the quantum extremal surface subscription that have different topologies. So they're both anchored on the same boundary region, they're both homologous to the same boundary region, but they're homotopic to different regions. So one, this dashed line at the top and bottom, horizontal lines is homotopic to region B, and the other, the vertical solid lines, is homotopic to the complementary region B bar. Okay, and these divide the bulk up into three regions, little b between the dashed lines and big B, little b bar between the solid lines and big B bar, and a central region between the two that I'm going to call little b prime. Okay, so this is true in vacuum ADS3, but it's also true even if we add some matter. And in particular, we can add an order epsilon over g Newton amount of energy to our spacetime, while only creating a small order epsilon back reaction on the geometry. This is just because the Einstein's equation has a g Newton in front of the energy, and so that cancels out with the 1 over g Newton here. Okay, so we create a tiny back reaction, order epsilon back reaction, but it roughly looks like the same geometry. If this matter is in a thermal state, so you can think of this matter as just like dust or radiation or something. The details don't matter too much. But if it's in a thermal state, it's going to have an entropy that grows extensively with the energy. And so it's also going to be order epsilon over g Newton. We can then tune the size of the region B to be sort of close, but not exactly half the entire boundary. Tune it to precision greater than epsilon, but independent of g Newton, such that the solid lines, which I'm going to call A, have area A1, have a smaller area than the dashed lines. So B is slightly over half the boundary. But in turn, the area of the dashed lines divided by 4 g Newton is smaller than the solid line over 4 g Newton plus the entropy of the matter sitting between the two. Okay, we're just going to choose our region B so that this is true. And we always can. Now we can set up a paradox. It's pretty simple. Going to consider three different quantum mechanical states. The first is just going to be some pure state of the matter sitting in the bulk. Okay, and in that case, there's no von Neumann entropy from the matter sitting in the bulk. So the generalized entropies of the two surfaces are just their areas over 4 g Newton. And in particular, the solid lines have a smaller area. They're the quantum extremal surface, the minimal quantum extremal surface. And so we find that the boundary entropy is just A1 divided by 4 g Newton. Okay, pretty simple. Step two is almost as simple. Let's now consider the state where the matter is in some thermal density matrix. Okay, in this case, the generalized entropy of the dashed lines is unchanged because there's no entropy between it and the boundary. But the generalized entropy of the solid lines is increased because it gets a contribution from all this bulk entropy sitting in the middle. Okay, So it increases to A1 over 4G plus S. By construction, that is bigger than A2. And so now we have a phase transition in the quantum extremal surface, and the entropy is just given by A2 over 4G Newton. Okay. So far, no problems. But now we're going to consider a third state, which is again going to be very simple. It's just going to be some mixture of probability P of being in the pure state and probability 1 minus P of being in the thermal state. Okay? So the bulk entropy up to small corrections is now just comes from the probability that it's thermal. So it's 1 minus P times the thermal entropy, S. And so the quantum extremal surface prescription is going to tell us that the entropy is going to be the smaller of either A2, right, the generalized entropy of the dash surface, or A1 plus 1 minus P times the thermal entropy. Okay, so as we dial P, starting with P equals 1, so it's definitely in the pure state, then initially the entropy is just A1, and then it steadily increases as we decrease 1 minus P, until it hits some point where A plus 1 minus P times S is equal to A2. And then there's a phase transition, and then after that it just stays flat and it saturates at A2. Okay. However, if the bulk state is a mixture of this pure state and the thermal state, then by the linearity of the bulk to boundary dictionary, the boundary state is also just a linear mixture of the boundary dual states. Okay. And it's in turn, the partial trace is a linear map, so that means the reduced state on region B is also just a linear mixture of the two states. If I take the linear mixture of two states, then up to sort of order one corrections, the entropy is always just a linear combination of the two entropies. So in this case, it's P times A1 plus 1 minus P times A2. Okay? These two formulas are just different. More than that, they're different at leading order. If I choose P to be small enough so that this thing is bigger than this thing, then the QES prescription is just saying that the entropy is A2, but linearity tells us, if we believe the QES prescription for the pure state and the thermal state, that it's instead P times A1 plus 1 minus P times A2. Okay, plus at most like 1 qubit. So these are just very different answers. They disagree at leading order. We have a major problem going on. We need to fix it somehow, or like nothing makes sense. Okay, so very briefly, I want to show how this shows up in evaporating black holes, because that means that can say the paper is about helping solve the information paradox. Obviously, terribly fashionable. This is a very heuristic picture from my paper from last May. We have a black hole after the page time. We have sort of the exterior of the black hole. It's represented up the top here. Imagine this whole thing is a cylinder. I'm just too lazy to do. It's like a 3D rotated thing. I'm just too lazy to draw that. We have the horizon here. It's pretty small. And as we go deep into the interior, we're effectively going back in time. And so it sort of gradually gets wider, the area gets larger, and you have a load of Hawking radiation that's entangled with stuff outside the black hole. Okay. And the QES prescription is clever enough to know that even though it seems like the entropy of this Hawking radiation is really, really big, actually, the quantum extremal surface is some non-empty surface that's just sitting at the horizon here. And the generalized entropy of that surface is just the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And so the entropy of the Hawking radiation is equal to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, consistent with unitarity. So everything is fine. QES prescription works great. But now we're going to do something very simple, which is just with probability P, we're going to measure all the Hawking radiation. And otherwise, we're just going to do nothing. Okay? So now we have some new state that's just a mixture of a superposition of the old state where there's this large amount of entanglement between Hawking radiation and the interior, and some new state where we measured all the Hawking radiation, so it's just in a product state with the interior. The QES prescription now says that the entropy is the smaller of the generalized entropy of this surface, which is still just the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, it hasn't changed, and the generalized entropy of the empty surface, which is now 1 minus P times the sort of semi-classical thermal entropy. With the same sort of arguments as the previous slides, if we have unitarity and linearity and so on, then the actual entropy has to be 1 minus P times the initial entropy, because if we've measured everything, it has entropy zero. If we haven't, it has entropy, Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So up to a small correction, the overall entropy has to be 1 minus P times the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And again, these just disagree at leading order. And in fact, if we choose P to be sufficiently big, wait, let me get this right, choose P to be sufficiently small, sorry, then we can set things up. Choose P to be sufficiently big, we can set things up so that the QES prescription is giving this answer, which is just the semi-classical answer. So the QES prescription is being just as wrong, it's being just as wrong in leading order as the sort of original Hawking semi-classical answer. So it's not helping us fix the unitarity problem whatsoever. Okay. So what I want to do now, before we move on to some sort of more detailed calculations that will give us the actual right answer, is explain a bit about why it's these mixtures of the two states, the thermal state and the pure state, that are the dodge ones, that are the ones where we shouldn't trust the QES prescription. And actually, the pure and thermal states, the QES prescription is fine, and there's no problems there. Because, you know, as everything I've said so far, it can be fixed by abandoning the QES prescription for any of the three different states. Okay. So to do that, I need to introduce these things from quantum information that are called smooth max and min entropies. My definition of smooth max entropy is going to be slightly a lie, but it's close enough. Up to a small error, it's the same as the usual definition. And that's the following. We're going to define it as the log of the rank, okay, which is equivalent data to just the rank, of the lowest rank state, rho tilde, that's epsilon close to our original state rho. Okay, so our original state rho might have infinite rank, for example. So for a thermal state, for example, it has infinite rank. But a large number of the eigenvalues in the Schmidt decomposition are really, 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 really tiny. I can like throw away all the smallest ones. We're only changing the state by a tiny, tiny amount. So basically what the smooth max entropy tells you to do, just keep throwing away all the smallest eigenvalues until it gets to the point where you're starting to affect the state by an order epsilon amount. Okay? And then look at the resulting rank, and that tells you what the smooth max entropy is. Roughly speaking, this characterizes the smallest Hilbert space that we can compress the state rho into and then eventually recover rho up to some order epsilon precision, right? We had to throw away some order epsilon amount, but we could do that and then we could get the rank small enough to fit into some Hilbert space. Another way of saying it and defining it is that it's a lower confidence bound. If I sample from the eigenvalues of rho with a probability distribution given by their eigenvalues, then it's a lower confidence bound on the size of a randomly chosen eigenvalue. Okay, so the von Neumann entropy tells you the expectation value of the log of the eigenvalue, but it's roughly speaking an estimate of sort of the median eigenvalue, right? It's not exactly that, but morally it's close enough to that. This is instead a lower confidence bound in the eigenvalue. This is saying with like probability 1 minus epsilon, a randomly chosen eigenvalue will be at least as big as e to the minus h max, 2 to the minus h. Well, it depends what units you use for your log, whatever. There's a complementary quantity called the smooth min entropy, which is defined as the log of the largest eigenvalue for the approximation of the state rho tilde that has the smallest, largest eigenvalue. Okay? In other words, it's an upper confidence bound on a randomly chosen eigenvalue. So together, this smooth min entropy and smooth max entropy gives you sort of an estimate of a range of eigenvalues between e to the minus h min and e to the minus h max, that with high probability a randomly chosen eigenvalue will be in that interval. Turns out you can also define conditional versions of these smooth min and max entropies. I'm not going to give the full formula for it because it's messy and complicated and unenlightening, honestly. But the key point is that for von Neumann entropies, conditional entropies are just defined as the difference between the entropy on AB minus the entropy on B. Okay, that's the conditional entropy of A conditioned on B. Conditional entropies are well defined for these smooth min and max entropies, but they're not just equal to the difference between two smooth min and max entropies in the same way. Okay, don't worry about these for now, but they will show up later in certain formulas. So having said that background about like the smooth min and max entropies and what their physical interpretation are, we can now start to see an intuition for why the mixture of the two states failed, but the thermal state and the pure state separately were fine. Okay. So a thermal state, if I have a thermal state of some large quantum mechanical system, then it can be well approximated by a state of rank e to the s plus subleading in s, where s is the von Neumann entropy of the thermal state. This is basically just a law of large numbers. The thermal state can be thought of as the product of thermal states, roughly the product of thermal states on some large number of smaller systems. And by law of large numbers, that gets dominated by, you know, the eigenvalues in the product get dominated by typical eigenvalues in the individual distributions. By typical entropy states, typical entropy strings. A mathematically equivalent statement is that the smooth max entropy of the thermal state is roughly equal to the von Neumann entropy, okay, up to some subleading correction. The same thing is obviously true for the pure state, because a pure state has zero von Neumann entropy and it has rank one, so it also has zero smooth max entropy. However, if we have a mixture of the two states, then being able to find a state that approximates the mixture always means that we can also find a state that approximates the thermal state almost as well, up to like a factor of two error, a factor of one over p error or something. So what does that mean? It means that the smooth max entropy is actually roughly equal to the von Neumann entropy of the thermal state and not to the von Neumann entropy of the mixture of the two. In other words, the smooth max entropy, H max, is bigger than the von Neumann entropy of the mixture by a factor of 1 minus p, 1 over 1 minus p. So the two, the smooth max entropy and the von Neumann entropy are very different. The state is sort of can't be compressed to anything like its e to its von Neumann entropy. As a general rule, we're going to find that these sort of large corrections can only show up when you have these sort of incompressible states, where the number of degrees of freedom that you need to compress the state, to encode the state, is much larger than the actual von Neumann entropy of the state. Okay. This is also what happens, you know, another way of saying this is it states where the thermodynamic limit doesn't apply, right? If the thermodynamic limit can be thought of as having a large number of copies of the state, and in that case, you have the law of large numbers come into play, and it just looks like a thermal state, for example. It can be compressed to roughly its entropy. Okay, so we're moving beyond the thermodynamic limit for the state bulk states. Okay, so we can now move on to sort of talking about how this actually gets fixed. And it turns out that a more careful gravitational entropy calculation gives a sense. Answer of you know, the answer using a path integral, where what you do, I'm getting that my internet connection is unstable. Can you still hear me? I think it's fine. Yeah. Okay, cool. So the answer is that what you do is you just first calculate what's called a Rényi entropy for an integer n. So the Rényi entropies are defined by this formula. Just trace rho to the n. That's something we can calculate using a path integral. And then we evaluate that for all values of n, get it as an analytic function of n somehow, and then analytically continue to the limit n goes to 1. When you do so, you can check by L'Hopital's rule that you get the von Neumann entropy. So how does this work in ADS-CFT? Well, to evaluate trace row to the n in ADS-CFT, we first need to construct n copies of row. So you do that using Euclidean path integrals. We need sort of one for each bra and one for each ket. That gives us 2n different Euclidean path integrals. Then we need to do a partial trace to get the reduced density matrix for each of them. Okay, that just means you glue together the bra boundary to the ket boundary, every part of the state that you're not interested in, right, that you want to throw away. So we glue together, for example, all the complement of region B here to the complement of region B up here. And we just do that in each of the n copies of the state. Then we need to glue all the reduced density matrices together to make trace of row to the n, okay? So again, that means you glue these independent copies of row together, but now rather than just gluing them together to individually, which would just give us trace of row to the power n, then we glue them together in a sort of cyclic cycle. So the bra here gets glued to the ket over here, the ket here gets glued to the bra over here, so on. Finally, the ket here gets glued to the bra here. So it all gets glued in one big cycle, and that gives us trace of row to the n. And finally, we want to evaluate this using the bulk dual. And to do that, we integrate over all bulk geometries that have this boundary condition. So this is now just one big boundary manifold. Everything got glued together. And in the semi-classical limit, that will get dominated by saddle points. Okay, and so we just can sum over those saddle points. Unfortunately, in general, doing this for arbitrary values of n is very hard. But there's a particular set of states that make the problem very simple, and you can do it. And these are called fixed area states. And basically what it means is you prepare some state, but then you measure the extremal surfaces of that state and you condition on getting some particular measurement outcome of some particular area. What does that mean? It means when you do the path integral to evaluate trace of row to the n, you don't have to integrate over the area of these extremal surfaces. In turn, that means when you look for a saddle point for these fixed area states, then the saddle points can have conical singularities sitting at these extremal surfaces. It's just now allowed. It's the same reason that if I measure x at some point in ordinary quantum mechanics path integral, then I can have a discontinuity in p at that point in a saddle point, right? The momentum can change because we measured x at that intermediate value. This eventually means is that the bulk geometry in this replicated manifold actually ends up looking exactly like the original bulk geometry, except that you have branch cuts sitting at these extremal surfaces. And these branch cuts permute the different sheets of the bulk geometry in order to match the boundary conditions. Having those branch cuts there introduces conical singularities at the extremal surfaces, but that's fine. We're allowing that because we measured them. Okay, and magically, as well, another nice feature is that when you do so, all these rows need to be normalized. And that means in the denominator, you have n copies of just the one sheet gravitational path integral. So the gravitational action just cancels out with the normalization factor, except that you get a contribution to the gravitational action from these conical singularities. And that contribution is very simple. It's just proportional to the area of the extremal surface times the deficit angle, the excess opening angle of the conical singularity. Okay, so that's something we can deal with. We just need to work out how these branch cuts work in order to find these manifolds. And the key point is that we know from the boundary conditions that this region, big B bar, has to be glued to the corresponding ket up here, right? So for the bulk geometry to match the boundary conditions, this bulk region next to big B bar also has to be glued to the same region up here. It can't get permuted around or we wouldn't fit the right boundary conditions. Similarly, this big B over here has to get glued to a big B with cyclically permuted ones around the cycle. And so similarly, these bulk regions that neighbor big B have to get glued into one another by cyclically permuting them around the cycle. However, we also have this region little b prime sitting in the middle between the two surfaces. And in fact, that can get glued, the bras can get glued to the kets using any permutation we want, because it just introduces a different branch cut on these surfaces. But that's fine, we're allowed to have branch cuts there because we're allowed to have conical singularities there. So all of these permutations are well-defined solutions, they're saddles. And so when we do the path integral, we should just sum over all of these saddles corresponding to all the permutations. And you get a formula that looks like this. Has some thing from the evaluated in quantum fields, and that space-time background. And it also gets a contribution from the gravitational action at the conical singularities. And we sum over all possible permutations in the central region. Okay. If we now said, okay, we're just going to take the leading saddle here, ignore all the rest, drop them, just take the leading one and then analytically continue that formula, we would get the naive QAS prescription. That's basically how the derivation of the naive QAS prescription works. Okay, but we know that's the wrong answer, so we shouldn't do that. We should be more careful. And instead, we're going to try to keep this whole sum and then analytically continue the entire sum to n goes to 1. So these C pi and C tau inverse pi in the action up here refer to the number of cycles in the permutation pi and in the permutation tau inverse composed with pi. Remember, tau inverse is just a cyclic, an arbitrary cyclic permutation. Okay? So these just show up because they control the size of the conical singularities you get. That's just some pretty simple maths. You can check it. I won't go into detail on it. But the key point is that these areas A1 and A2 are formally infinite, right? They diverge as we go out to the asymptotic boundary. The difference between them is finite, but the area itself is formally infinite. That means that any saddle that doesn't maximize the sum of these two, C pi and C tau inverse pi, will be suppressed by some factor of either e to the minus A1 or e to the minus A2, and that's infinite. So it's infinitely suppressed. So the only saddles we have to keep are the ones that maximize this sum, and they're associated, they're one-to-one correspondence with what's called non-crossing partitions. They're sometimes called non-crossing permutations. I'm not going to go into detail of how that works, but there's some subset of the permutations that have this property. And what we want to do is analytically continue the sum over all of them to non-integer values of n, and then eventually to the limit n goes to 1. The problem, of course, is the number of terms in the sum depends on n, right? So as n gets larger, there are more possible permutations, even when you require them to be non-crossing. And so the number of terms in the sum increases. So that's like very hard to do in a naive way, because we just have some, you know, we can't make the number of terms in the sum go to a non-integer value when we go to non-integer n. It's just not obvious how you analytically continue this thing. Fortunately, these sort of non-crossing permutations have been studied to death in what's called free probability theory. And there's a whole set of technology that lets you find formulas for them. But roughly speaking, it's just Schringer Dyson equations. But it lets you basically do this analytic continuation. This is a simple enough, at least for the simple examples we're going to consider, you can, do that. And the way it works is you consider what's called the resolvent, just defined as the trace of the inverse of lambda for some scalar lambda minus rho. And it's easy to see by just doing a Taylor series expansion that this thing is just determined by trace of rho to the n, right, for all values of n, for integer n. So if we know trace of rho to the n, we can in principle work this thing out, though it can be complicated. And in turn, if you can work out the resolvent, then you can check that if you look at the limit as lambda goes to approaches the real axis from above, then the imaginary part of this resolvent gives you the density, eigenvalue density spectrum for rho, okay? In the special case where we just have a mixture, sorry, the upcoming paper there should refer to the already out paper from August. I keep forgetting to change that. For the special case where we just have a mixture of pure state and thermal state, turns out that the formulas for trace of rho to the n allow you to find a recursion relation for the resolvent R. And it's this formula here, which is kind of messy and complicated. But at the end of the day, it's just a cubic equation for R. And cubic equations can be solved. So in principle, we could just find R, we write down a formula for it. But of course, the general solution of the cubic equation is horrible. Nobody ever learned anything useful from it. So we're not going to do that. We're instead going to be a bit cleverer, and we're going to note the following. We're going to note that this term has some huge thing in the denominator, e to the a1 over 4g plus s, some huge, huge factor. So unless r itself is really, really, really huge, then it's tiny compared to this thing, which is really quite big, and we can just forget about it, okay? So small enough r, then that term can be dropped. Similarly, if r really is that big, then this term will get really, really big, and this term can be dropped, okay? And the key point is that because this has an extra factor of e to the s in the denominator, which is some big thing, and this doesn't, there's some overlapping range of r's for which both the approximations are simultaneously valid. So these two approximations can completely characterize the solution. And in either case, once we made that simplification, then we end up with a quadratic equation for r. And quadratic equations are very nice. And they're, you know, the solution is actually a useful thing. It's a thing school kids use. And in particular, it has a non-zero imaginary part and hence a non-zero eigenvalue density when the discriminant is negative, right? When b squared minus 4ac is less than zero. Turns out that for each of these approximations, you get some range of lambdas for which the discriminant is negative, and hence that you get a sort of non-zero peak in the eigenvalue spectrum. And so you find that the sort of eigenvalue density spectrum of rho has a peak here that looks like where the lambda is p times e to the minus a1. So this peak is the peak that you would expect from the part of the state that comes from the pure state, right? In the pure state, all the eigenvalues would be roughly e to the minus a1, but we multiplied that state by p and then added the thermal state. So this is the part that comes from that pure part of the state. And we have another peak from the other approximation that looks like one minus p times e to the minus a2. This is the part that comes from the thermal state part of the mixture. Okay, so we just get some eigenvalues from one, some eigenvalues from the other. We can find the entanglement entropy just by integrating lambda log lambda against this eigenvalue density. And of course, we do indeed find that the entropy is just a mixture of the two entropies. It's just a weighted sum of the average of the weighted average of the two entropies plus some small correction. Okay, so the answer you get by doing the replica trick in a careful, systematic way, not dropping any saddle points, doing the full sum, analytic continue using this technology, is exactly the answer that's consistent with the fact that it's a linear mixture of two states. So that's great. Everything works out. But of course, that was just some very particular, very simple examples of quantum states. And what we'd really like to have is some general rule for if the quantum extremal surface description isn't always right, then what rule should we use instead? Okay, and that's gonna be doable, answerable to some extent. It's not gonna be able to give a complete answer. I think the complete answer is it's just complicated. But that's gonna be the aim of this next section of the talk, okay? So the bad news is that if I have some just general arbitrary entangled bulk state, even if it's a fixed area state, then the current tools from free probability and so on, or at least the tools that have been successfully found by physicists working in this area, are insufficient to actually do the replica trick calculations, to actually solve for the resolvent and find the density of states and then the entropy. Okay, and to see whether the quantum extremal surface description works or not. So that's not good, but there's a nice clever trick that lets us get around that. And that's that we can note that this formula that we found a few slides ago for the fixed area states, for a general fixed area state, is exactly the same as the formula that you find for a very simple random tensor network. So here, this is a random tensor sitting in the middle. You have some input bulk state on little b prime, and little b bar. And then we have outputs of this tensor, which have dimensions e to the a2 and e to the a1, respectively. And then we just apply some unitaries or whatever, and we call the output states rho big b and rho big b bar. Okay? And the formulas for trace of rho big b to the n, in this case, are exactly the same can just show this explicitly as the formula you get for the fixed area states in gravity. What does that mean? It means if we can mathematically find any, if we can solve for the answer in the tensor network case using any method we like, not necessarily using a replicatory calculation, just using some method of solving the problem, then we've automatically also learned what the answer is in gravity, right? Because we know in principle that tracer rho to the n determines all determines the von Neumann entry, and tracer rho to the n is the same in both cases. So even if we can't directly use those formulas to find the von Neumann entry, we know that's the von Neumann entry it has to give because we know it's the right answer for the tensor network. Okay, so this isn't just we're going to solve for tensor networks and hope that there's an analogy to gravity. This is we're using the tensor networks to just do some maths that we can't otherwise do. It's not doing any physics for us. Happily, this question of like the entropies in tensor networks is something that one-shot quantum Shannon theory, you know, in somewhat different form, the one-shot quantum Shannon theory people care about all the time. And you can use those answers to get a general rule for when the QES prescription applies and when it doesn't. Okay. So one slightly unusual way to write this sort of normal, naive quantum extremal surface prescription is the following. It's given by A1 over 4G plus S little b prime, i.e. the generalized entropy of surface gamma 1, the solid lines, if the conditional entropy of the stuff in little b prime, conditioned on little b, is less than the difference between the two areas over 4G. Okay, this really just means that the generalized entropy, this is just rewriting the fact that this is true if this is smaller than the generalized entropy of gamma 2, the bottom formula, okay? And similarly, if this conditional entropy is bigger than the area difference, then we have the bottom formula. Okay, this is just a very complicated way of saying it's the smaller of these two things. The refined QES prescription that you get from doing the tensor network calculations, and hence for fixed area states in gravity, is the following. The QES prescription is right, and it is indeed A1 over 4G plus the von Neumann entropy of the stuff in little b and little b prime. Not if the conditional von Neumann entropy is less than the area difference, but if the conditional smooth max entropy is less than the difference between the two areas. Similarly, the QES prescription is right, and the answer is A2 over 4G plus S of little b, if the conditional smooth min entropy is bigger than the area difference. However, in general, there can be a big gap between the conditional smooth min entropy and the conditional smooth max entropy. And if the conditional smooth min entropy is smaller than the area difference, but the max entropy is bigger, then the QES prescription just isn't valid. And instead, the answer is just some smaller, it's smaller than either of these things. And the details of it just seem to be complicated. There's not just some simple one-size-fits-all answer. It depends on the whole details of the spectrum of the wave function. Okay. So this is... Yeah?
I think, Anthony raised his hand. I don't know if you... Do you want to take questions right away?
Yeah, definitely. I hadn't seen.
Hi, Jeff. This condition that you wrote down, it looks like H max depends on epsilon. Is that right? And yeah. So like what? Yeah. I would think it's zero if epsilon's zero, right? So.
You need epsilon to be non-zero. I'm trying to avoid talking about the scaling of epsilon. The answer is that we scale epsilon slightly differently depending on which direction we're proving in these things. But roughly speaking, make epsilon polynomially small in G Newton, but definitely not exponentially small. It's roughly. But you, first to prove certain other things, we need to make epsilon be small but order one. So what you really want is the smooth max entropy to not depend too much on epsilon, which is often the case.
Epsilon's different from the one that you were talking about on like the energy density or something. It's just some other parameter, or is this
it's the same one. It's the same epsilon. It's the tolerance of the state. It's how much. It's the size of the areas you care about, basically. right? You basically say, I don't care about errors smaller than order epsilon, but I do care about ones that are larger than epsilon. Okay. You can see detailed precise statements involving epsilon in the paper, but generally, you know, try to avoid talking too much about exactly how big epsilon needs to be for different things. Okay, cool. Yeah, great question. So just to give you some vague intuition for you know, why these things show up, using a certain definition that we'll come to later in the talk, called quantum state merging, this smooth conditional max entropy is the number of qubits that you need to communicate the state on little b prime to someone who already knows the state on little b. Okay, so roughly speaking, you can think of this as saying that you need to be able, the QAS prescription applies if the state on little b prime can be communicated to someone who already knows the stuff in little b in less than a2 minus a1 over 4g qubits. Okay, that's just vague intuition for the moment. We'll make it more precise later. But you might also wonder why the smooth min entropy shows up here. That one is really quite simple to justify. So for pure states on little b prime, little b bar, it turns out that the smooth conditional min entropy of little b prime conditional on little b is equal to minus the smooth conditional max entropy on little b prime conditioned on little b bar. Okay, so that means this is equivalent to, sorry, this condition is equivalent to the smooth conditional max entropy of little b prime conditional on little b bar being less than a1 minus a2 over 4g. That is exactly just this condition, except with big B and big B bar swapped over. For a pure state, S of big B has to be equal to S of big B bar. And so that has to be the answer. Okay, so that's just some vague intuition for why you have this sort of duality between min ones here and max ones here. Okay, we'd also like to have a rule that applies even when you don't just have fixed area states. And again, for non-fixed area states, the replica geometries get horrid. We can't even work out trace of rho to the n. However, if we have some semi-classical holographic state, then we can write it as a superposition over some sort of polynomially many different fixed area states, right? Where by fixed area, I mean area has been measured to polynomial precision in G-Newton. By general sort of arguments about entropies of a mixture being given by the expectation over the entropies in the mixture, pretty similar morally to the ones we saw at the beginning of the talk, then that means that at leading order, the entropy of the semi-classical state is just given by the expectation of the entropies of the states in the superposition. Okay? So at leading order, we just get exactly the same formulas as we found for the fixed area states. If you go to, you do in fact get order 1 over square root g Newton corrections, but those are from the fluctuations in the area, but those are subleading effects. They were talked about by paper by Domarov and collaborators, and also one by Xidong and collaborators a few months ago. So the final thing I want to talk about is just, I want to connect this to entanglement wedge reconstruction, how the QAS prescription ties into entanglement wedge reconstruction, how this is a refinement of the rules for entanglement wedge reconstruction, and also connected a bit to the sort of things people care about in one-shot quantum Shannon theory, specifically quantum state merging. Okay. So entanglement wedge reconstruction is the idea that everything between the minimal quantum extremal surface and the boundary region is actually encoded from a boundary perspective in that boundary region, right? So that's the sort of slightly vague definition that you need to make precise. The sort of traditional way to make it precise is to define a code subspace and say that for states in that code subspace, then there needs to be operators on the boundary that do the same thing, blah, blah, blah. But actually a better version that we introduced this talk, or sort of a generalization of that, is just if we have some bulk density matrix, rho, and we have some bulk operator that acts within the entanglement wedge, then we need to find a boundary operator that acts the correct way, same way as the bulk operator on a purification of that bulk density matrix row. Okay? If the bulk density matrix is a maximally mixed state in a code space, then this is just the usual definition in terms of a code subspace. But this is a generalization because we can consider other bulk states that aren't sort of maximally mixed on some code subspace. Turns out when you define entanglement reconstruction precisely in this way, then the condition you find for being able to reconstruct bulk operators sitting in the middle here is exactly the same condition as for the quantum extremal surface prescription to be true with QES gamma 1. In other words, we need this conditional smooth max entropy of this stuff in the middle to be less than the difference between the two areas. And the way that works is just, you know, very similar arguments about replica tricks. You know, entanglement reconstruction can be done using PETS map. PETS map can be, the action of the PETS map can be calculated using a replica trick. I'm not going to go into details of how it works, but you can see it in the paper. Okay, but what I really want to do is just sort of say a few words about how this connects to one-shot quantum state merging. So one-shot quantum state merging is the following task. So what happens is that Alice and Bob share, I swear I edited all these things and they've gone away. Okay, Alice and Bob share some density matrix row, and their aim is to transfer Alice's part of the state to Bob. Okay, so they know what their density matrix is, but so you might say, well, this is trivial because just Bob can just make a copy of the density matrix row AB if he knows what it is. That's not what they're wanting to do. They're assuming that their density matrix is purified by some third system, and they're wanting the density matrix Bob ends up with, which is also row AB, to still purify that same system. Okay, so they actually have to send Alice's part of the state over to Bob, and they want to do that by sending as few qubits as possible from Alice to Bob. Okay, that's the rules of the game. Turns out this is literally just the Schrodinger picture version of our precise definition of entanglement reconstruction, where sort of Bob's part of the state is the bulk state in region little B prime, and Alice's part of the state is the bulk state in region little B prime. Sorry, Bob's state is region little B, Alice's is region little B prime. So how does this make sense? Well, we're imagining Bob, or sort of the final Bob, is like a boundary observer with access to big B. Okay, so he can always reconstruct the stuff in little b, because that's always in the entanglement wedge. So he already has access to that part of the state, but then he learns some information about little b prime, but that information can be kind of noisy, right? Because he doesn't necessarily learn everything about little b prime, and he wants to try to reconstruct it. So he receives some information about little b prime, and his task is to use that plus his already existing knowledge about little b to reconstruct the state. If you can reconstruct the state, then in the Heisenberg picture, you can apply operators. Okay. Magically, the minimum number of qubits required to do one-shot quantum state merging is exactly the conditional smooth max entropy of A conditioned on B, i.e. of little b prime conditioned on little b. And the maximum number of qubits from region little b that you can learn about in region big B, the number you can sort of not know and still reconstruct, is exactly given by the difference between the two areas. Okay, that was shown in a paper I wrote a couple of years ago with Patrick Hayden. But what this seems to be telling us is that gravity is saturating this bound for the minimum number of qubits required to be able to do one-shot quantum state merging. Whenever it's like possible information theoretically, then gravity like manages to do it. However, there's a big but here that I've been glossing over. When in one-shot quantum state merging, traditionally, you assume that you're allowed to send as much classical information from Alice to Bob as you want. Okay, so they're allowed to talk on the phone and say, oh, hey, I did a measurement on my part of the state and I got this outcome and stuff like that. Okay, it's only by doing that that they're able to send only conditional smooth max entropy number of qubits. Otherwise, they need significantly more. So this is obviously very weird because in gravity, you can't learn any more classical bits from region Little B prime, then you can learn qubits. The number of classical bits was bounded by Ning Bao and Hiroshi Uguri just by bounding the Halevo information, paper back in 2018 as well. So you have no classical side channel. So how on earth is gravity doing this? Well, again, I'm not really going to go into detail on this, but it turns out that on top of the qubits you can learn from region little b prime, on gravity you also learn a load of what's called zero bits of little b prime, which is an additional source of information that I'm not going to define. It's less useful than learning classical bits, like it's a less powerful quantum information resource than classical bits, but it turns out it's basically the minimum sufficient resource to be able to do quantum state merging. So it's exactly the thing you need to be able to do quantum state merging with only HMax qubits being sent. So that's sort of how gravity is able to do entanglement wedge reconstruction. You need enough qubits, and you also have enough zero bits to be able to do it with that number of qubits. But it saturates all the bounds. It's as efficient as possible. As with, you know, a lot of things, gravity is as clever as it can be. Basically because random channels is clever, saturate all these bounds. Okay, so I promise I'm nearly done because I've been talking for an hour already. I'm sorry this part is like a lightning, like one slide on topic without explaining any of the details. But the final thing I want to sort of introduce, because I think it's quite interesting and there's some interesting open questions there, is that until now, we've sort of assumed that we just have these two extremal surfaces, gamma one and gamma two, right? And we've assumed that nothing else matters other than these extremal surfaces. But in general, you could imagine some complicated space-time. Maybe you have a network of wormholes or something where you have some large number of extremal surfaces. And in general, you might even think like maybe it's not just extremal surfaces that matter. What about other non-extremal surfaces? You'd like some sort of general rule for just in arbitrary situations working out what can be reconstructed and what can't. So there's a very natural rule that you can, again, prove for fixed area states and so on, at least for case where you have a large number of extremal surfaces. And that involves defining two new regions, which we call the maxi-W and the mini-W. So the maxi-W, I should say this is all just for static states, by the way, or time-symmetric states. So the maxi-W is defined as the largest region, little b, such that if I take any chunk subset of that region, little b prime, then the conditional max entropy of the leftover stuff in B conditioned on the subset is less than the difference between the areas bounding the subset and the full region. Okay, so it's the largest region satisfying that property. And the claim is that this is basically the region that is fully encoded in B, that any operator in this region can be reconstructed in big B properly. There's also another region called the mini W, which is sort of complementary in a certain way. And this is defined as the smallest region, little b, such that if we add any chunk little b bar prime to it, then the conditional min entropy of that extra bit conditioned on b is going to be bigger than the difference between the two areas, the difference between the initial area and the area where you add in this extra chunk little b bar prime. This is going to turn out to be the region that is has any influence at all on the state B, right? That you know, changing anything stuff in that region, changing something outside that region will not change the reduced state on big B whatsoever. If changing something inside that region can change the state, even if it might not be fully reconstructable in that state. Finally, if and only if these two things are the same thing, maybe up to some perturbative difference between them or something, but basically the same thing at leading order, then we define them to be equal to the entanglement wedge, the EW. Otherwise, we just say that the entanglement wedge is not defined. Okay, and again, all of this is only defined for static states. And I just want to make one brief comment, which is that there can exist certain degrees of freedom outside the max EW that are completely reconstructible in it. And there can exist degrees of freedom inside the mini W that just don't influence the state at all. But the maxi W and the mini W are defined as the regions where it's like guaranteed that everything is reconstructible or that nothing outside that is reconstructible. Okay. So you can prove a load of things about these min and maxi Ws. I encourage you to see the paper for the proofs. It's just using certain inequalities that these smooth entropies satisfy and, you know, usual facts about like gravity, the geometry. So the first is you might worry that these things aren't well-defined at all, right? We defined it as the largest region satisfying some property and the smallest region satisfying that property. But what if you just have overlapping regions that satisfy that property, but the union doesn't? Then there's like not a well-defined largest region that satisfies it. Turns out that if you don't work at too high precision, then that can never happen. These are well-defined things. There's a well-defined largest satisfying the maxi W condition, larger well-defined smallest satisfying the mini W condition. So they are sensible things to talk about. Second thing is that for pure states, the maxi W of one region is equal to the mini W of the complementary region. Okay, again, this makes sense. Like if no information about some region escapes out to big B, then all of it must escape out to big B bar and vice versa. So this is sensible. Third is that the maxi W is contained within the mini W. Again, the region that can totally be reconstructed needs to be contained within the region that can influence the state at all, right? Because something can't influence the state, clearly can't be reconstructed. The fourth is that if we consider two boundary regions, one of which is contained within the other, so we have B1 is contained within B2, then the min and max EWs for B1 are contained respectively within the min and max EWs for B2. Okay, so you have nesting of these min and max EWs. And again, this needs to be true, right? If we can reconstruct something using B1, then clearly we can reconstruct it using B2. If it can influence B1, it can clearly influence B2. And finally, if the min EW is equal to the max EW, then you can show that the generalized entropy is minimized by that surface. Okay, so what does that mean? It means for the situations where we say that the entanglement wedge is well-defined, then its definition is the same as the usual definition that just involves minimizing the generalized entropy. Okay, so the two definitions are consistent. It's just we're restricting the circumstances where it's well-defined at all. Okay, so that's really all I have to say. So just leave you with some final comments. The big takeaway, I think, of this paper is that, you know, the QAS prescription knows a lot. It knows about the page curve, but it doesn't know everything. But the replica trick definitely knows more than the QAS prescription. I don't know if the replica trick knows everything, but it knows a hell of a lot. The second big part takeaway is that from a sort of quantum information point of view, there was always something very weird going on, which is that holography only involves a single copy of a state. Okay, and yet Bogdan von Neumann entropies seem to be playing a crucial role in things like determining whether entanglement wedge reconstruction is possible. In one-shot quantum Shannon theory, von Neumann entropies barely show up. They have basically no operational role. So that was always kind of weird. And the answer from this paper is that actually it was always smooth min and max entropies that were important, as in ordinary one-shot quantum Shannon theory. Just normally we were considering sort of thermodynamic bulk states, things like thermostates and so on, where the smooth min and max entropies were the same as the von Neumann entropy, so we could get away with just using the von Neumann entropy. But the real things are the things that actually play an operationally important role in information theoretically. Final thing is that there's a lot of open questions that are sort of left by this work. I encourage people to think about it if you find it interesting. The first is that this sort of general definition of min and max EWs was just for static states. We'd like a sort of covariant definition for time-dependent spacetimes with, like, you know, not when you just have two extremal surfaces, that's fine, but when you have some arbitrary complicated spacetime. And I think I think I know what the right answer is for that, but it showing that it makes sense and is well-defined and so on will require sort of generalizing quantum focusing conjecture and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of interesting questions that could come out of it. Another thing is that, yeah, we derived the refined QES for fixed area states by basically comparing notes with tensor networks and then doing the tensor network derivation using completely different techniques. It feels like there should be a much more direct way to see the approximations that give you QES are valid if trace of rho to the n has certain properties, if rho has the correct properties, and are not valid if it doesn't. We should be able to see directly what the approximation breaking down and the analytic continuation. And I don't know how to do that. I think it's a very interesting open question. Yeah, that's all I have. Thanks a lot for listening, everyone.
All right. Thanks a lot for this very nice talk. Let's turn to questions. Let's see if there are any. Well, what will people think of questions? Maybe let me ask like a very quick one. So, do you think that something similar, like these large deviations, could happen for space sense which are like far from a semi-classical limit, in the sense that you have like a chunk of matter here and a chunk of matter there, but they're like in superposition. So,
if the matter has a large entropy and it's superposition, that basically creates a large amount of entanglement between the different regions, right? Superposition of position of the matter is entanglement between the reduced density matrices of the regions. So you can certainly have that happen then. One other comment is that people have recognized for a while that if I have a superposition of two different space-time, very different space-time geometries, which I think connects to, you'll sort of get this if you have a superposition of matter and you have back reaction and stuff, then the Weotaki-Nagy formula needs to be adjusted to encompass that. And the people sort of recognized for a long time what's the right answer, which is you need to use like a linear area operator, and that's the expectation of the area operator of the different things in the superposition. In some sense, what this paper is doing is recognizing that we need to treat, even if we have a single geometry, we can have the same effect happen from bulk entropies. So they really are the same thing. Let's say you have a superposition, you have two black holes, and you have a superposition of either them being in a product state plus some order one probability of them being really, really highly entangled, right? From one point of view, that's just a weird bulk state that smooth max and min entropies have weird properties, and that causes these problems. But from another point of view, if the entangled state is like the thermofield double state, then it's the superposition of two different classical geometries. And we already knew from that you had to take the linear expectation of the two things in that case. So this is making the Weotaki and Nagy formula consistent so that we get the same answer for when we treat it as quantum entanglement as when we treat it as classical area. And actually I didn't talk about this, but there's a very nice, so all these things, like the generalized entropies and stuff, or the smooth min and max entropies, they're divergent. They need to be renormalized. And they presumably need to be renormalized by the area term, just like the von Neumann entropy is. But if you actually look, their divergences are like pretty similar to the von Neumann entropy divergence, but they have a subleading difference. Hmm. And that subleading difference is exactly the fluctuations in the area. So what it really seems like is that the smooth min and max entropies need to be renormalized by like upper and lower confidence bounds on the area. And so what you get is like a min and max generalized entropies. And these whole conditions with the conditional entropies just becomes basically whether the conditional generalized entropy, conditional min and max generalized entropies are bigger than or greater than zero. And that includes both these fluctuation corrections that Zhidong and Don Morel from people have been thinking about, and the corrections we're finding, and everything just in one simple formula involving this one renormalized UV finite quantity. That's something we didn't work out the details of checking that all makes sense.